just want to preface this lecture with something about my research interests. I'm very interested in theater history, but also material culture and women's history as well. And so that work has brought me to my work on cosmetics. I published a book on cosmetics in Shakespearean and Renaissance drama in 2006. And so a lot of my work on beauty and aesthetics in the period has now been very much focused on how that beauty is represented on the stage in the commercial playhouses of London. And so we are indeed building an indoor theater, and we will be lighting early modern performances with candles. And so one of the research interests in particular for us, or for me, I should say, is the relationship or the interplay between lighting, faces, and costume in the early modern indoor playhouse. So my lecture is very much focused around that particular research interest. So as I said, I'm going to talk to you today about the relationship between cosmetic beauty and performance in the Blackfriars Theatre during the Jacobean period. Some of the things that I'm going to ask you to think about. First of all, what was the beauty ideal during the Renaissance period? What cosmetic materials were women actually putting on their faces in order to achieve this ideal? Was there a cosmetics industry, so to speak? How did playwrights respond to the ideology and practice of beauty in the period? What did the women who went to see and hear plays at the Blackfriars Theatre look like? How did the male actors perform this beauty, specifically in the indoor playhouse? And finally, what overall effect might have been created by the interplay between cosmetic beauty, candlelight, and performance? So thinking very much, first of all, about setting the scene and the beauty ideal. In this period, the beauty ideal is perhaps easy enough to guess. If you've ever seen a film about Queen Elizabeth I, there were distinctive qualities that she was believed to have typified. And women spent a good deal of time attempting to emulate her. So I'm going to show you just a few filmic representations to show you what some of these features might have been that constituted the Renaissance beauty ideal, albeit in these films, they're often exaggerated, and the effect of the cosmetic paints is exaggerated as well. So a high forehead, perhaps though not this high. Then you have slightly rosy cheeks, and I, again, exaggerated here, and then the white face. Now, while this seems perhaps a bit more accurate, this depiction is perhaps still not as beautiful as we understand it. I remember when some of my students went to see the movie Elizabeth, they asked me when they came out, why does she turn herself into a monster at the end? When actually that scene when she's painting her face, she isn't actively turning herself into a monster. So why is it that that aesthetic, that beauty, hasn't actually come across in some of these filmic representations is quite curious. But what this film seemed to get close to is the notion that a woman's mysterious dark eyes and ruby lips had to appear to emerge from an almost blank canvas of white, fair skin. Let's just think about the features of female beauty more closely for a moment. An aesthetic that was in place for centuries, pale white skin, a light blush or rosy cheek, typifying the battle for superiority between the lily and the rose on the cheek of a woman. Ruby lips, dark eyes, a high but not a dominant forehead. In fact, we know from Roman authors such as Ovid that this beauty standard dates back as far as classical antiquity. Here's Elizabeth in, as some have argued, a masking costume, seen as a mature beauty, though perhaps Elizabeth was painted from a facial pattern, as we believe. But what is clear is that the archetype of beauty remains the same throughout her reign and carried over well into the Jacobean period. So what I want to do first is just take you back to the origins, the Western ideal of human beauty, and specifically female beauty. Keeping in mind, though, that it doesn't strictly apply to women, the motif of the Adonis, or beautiful boy, also featured in the rhetoric of beauty during the early modern period. which is relevant when we think about the fact that boys play the parts of women on the public stages of Elizabethan and Jacobean London, and they did so often very convincingly. So the origins of the ideal can be found in classical philosophy. But what was this classical paradigm of beauty? Well, we start with proportion, a largely Aristotelian concept that proportion of parts was key to beauty. It became a very important Renaissance value that was crucial to art, poetry, and architecture. The English writer George Putnam says in The Art of English Poesy, "All things stand by proportion, and that without it, nothing could stand to be good or beautiful." What Putnam implies here is that proportion is a defining principle when judging goodness and beauty, and this principle can be applied to art as well as to the human body. The second feature is symmetry. Aristotle says in the Metaphysics that the universal elements of beauty are order or taxis, symmetry, and definiteness. We also have harmony as a crucial quality of beauty, or order, as some have referred to it, and it was seen as generally as important as symmetry and proportion in ancient theory. Then you have some more abstract qualities, which are basically a reflection of virtue. Plato uniquely saw beauty as rooted in ideas and abstract qualities. He personifies beauty, seeing it as the goddess who presides at childbirth, as he put it. And he distinguishes between absolute beauty and divine beauty, both being associated with purity. For him, outer beauty would be a reflection of inner virtue. Now, these views, specifically about beauty, were inherited by Renaissance thinkers who expanded on this, adapting the classical ideal to their own ideas about aesthetics, religion, and social class. And all of this fed into the ideal inherited by Shakespeare and his contemporaries in England. The Neoplatonist Marsilio Ficino, whose reshaping of Plato's philosophy of beauty gives it its Christian significance. He argued that beauty is a kind of force or light shining from him through everything. This idea is sustained throughout the early modern period. For Neoplatonists such as Ficino, then beauty itself should generate from the light of the soul. This visible glow is imagined as God's image radiating from beneath the surface of the body, therefore a powerful manifestation of virtue. The link is firmly established here, then, between goodness, purity, and beauty. Beauty is something that shines forth, and this is the quality of the beauty ideal that I'd like to focus on here. The poet John Bodnam's Belvedere, or the Garden of Muses, published in 1600, imagines virtue, repeatedly as that which shines. Like to the sun, so virtue lights the world. Virtue will shine through, ne'er so much obscured. Virtue makes women seem to be divine. Virtue in beauteous bodies shineth best. You also find words such as luster, shine, glow, glisten, shimmer, frequently accompanying idealized descriptions of female beauty, referring to the most essential quality of a woman's complexion in this period. You also find phrases such as heavenly grace in the poetic lyrics of the period, glistering gloss of beauty's blaze, for example. Now, famous mainly for his treatise on beauty, the Florentine poet Agnolo Firenzola's definition provides an itemized description of the ideal woman. Describing the proportions of her body down to the length of her fingers, Firenzola also spends a great deal of time commenting on the requisite chromatic harmony in a woman's face. He insists the cheeks must be fair. Fair is a color that, besides being white, also has a certain luster, as ivory does. This distinction that Firenzola makes between whiteness and ivory lies in the word luster. It would seem that the terms fair and white are not always to be taken as interchangeable. Fairness conveys a luster that is comparable to silver, or more to the point, to pearl, and pearl is something I'm going to talk about at length in a moment. The painting of a lady in white by Titian is Venetian, yes,
which I'll show you.
And shows Venetian fashion, but the facial beauty and the emphasis on luster is undeniable. And of course, don't forget that England inherited a lot of continental ideas about beauty, and certainly they also inherited a lot of ingredients that were exported out of the continent into England. So this facial beauty, the emphasis on luster, is valued throughout Europe and England well into the 17th century. Please note also the texture of her dress, its iridescent quality, created by the certain ingredients in the paints. And what's also interesting is that paints were made of the same ingredients that women used on their faces. So there's a lot of material links between aesthetic beauty that you see on canvases and that you see on women's faces. In the poetry of the period as well, you find many references comparing beautiful women to Cynthia or Phoebe, which are other names for the moon, invoking not only chastity, but the divine qualities of Queen Elizabeth I, who was often apostrophized as Cynthia and Phoebe. Some Renaissance writers formulating the ideals of beauty recommended a metaphorical cosmetic that would reflect this inner virtue on the outer skin. So painting the soul becomes almost a counter-cosmetic discourse in the period. For example, Annabel Rome's Neoplatonic dialogue, The Courtier's Academy, translated into English in 1598, suggests procuring an intelligible beauty, as he calls it. It requires bedecking our souls with prudence, fortitude, temperance, and justice. In doing so, women will secure a most precious quality which shineth in the universal frame. What Rome does here is align physical or facial luster with purity, suggesting prudence, fortitude, temperance, and justice are perhaps the only appropriate cosmetic ingredients. And you see this throughout the anti-cosmetic discourse in the 16th and in the 17th centuries in England. By the 17th century, the philosophy of beauty was continuing to develop, but the key precepts remained constant: pale, glistening complexion. And it's really important that when you think of the word fair in this context, that you think not just of the pale complexion, but also the shiny or luster or glistening complexion. An English translation of Thomas Bioni's Problems of Beauty, published in 1606, offers up further definitions in the form of a dialogue, with questions posed about beauty and its uses. Like many before him, Bioni celebrates an idealized form, which should reflect the white in the snow, as he says, and the red in the rose. He invokes this Neoplatonic discourse that I've been talking about, suggesting that women's faces should indeed correspond to the cosmos, that is, the celestial and radiant beauty of the heavens. Who beholds and rests not astonished, he says, at the clear light of the moon, the bright beams of the sun, the whiteness of silver, and the splendor of gold. Like the heavens, the ideal woman should glisten and sparkle like silver or gold, like the sun or the moon. A few years on, William Austin goes so far as to declare that a woman's face is the very epitome of heaven itself. Now, the etymological registers in cosmos and cosmetics may become apparent when we consider the poetic and prescriptive discourses that attributed this celestial quality to female beauty. Given these prescriptions, we might ask ourselves now how the Renaissance woman, who perhaps couldn't make her skin glow through virtue alone, might achieve this artificially. And this will lead to the question of exactly what cosmetic materials were women putting on their faces to achieve this ideal? The first thing I suppose we should establish is that in the Renaissance, cosmetics could indeed bring about beauty regardless of those filmic representations that you saw of Queen Elizabeth I. Painted beauty was alluring. It was attractive. If painted portraits are anything to go on, the conventions of female beauty are visually tied to artistic representations of beauty. If these paintings are indeed arousing, then a painted lady in the flesh may be even more alluring, making fantasies about the period's painted pinups a reality. Some of the material ingredients used to paint canvases, as I said earlier, were also used to paint faces. And this curious material connection is evident in the period's recipe books. And there are hundreds of recipe books, and those are just the printed ones. As you might be aware, there are lots of manuscripts that women would pass down generation to generation with loads more recipes. Bound together with culinary and medicinal recipes, you find pages and pages of cosmetic recipes as well. Cosmetic recipe manuals from the 16th and 17th centuries, such as William Ward's translation of Girolamo Rosselli's The Secrets of Alexis of Piedmont, also take up the idiom of fairness, frequently offering concoctions that suggest ways of producing recipes that, as he says, maketh a fair skin, for example. Or, he says, a water that maketh the face white and shining. So even those who were writing recipe manuals were remembering to use the term fair and shining in order to get women to buy some of these cosmetic manuals. There are facial cleansers that require, as you see here, the milk of an ass and eggshells, and make thereof a distilled water, and wash your face with it, and it will be white, fair, and glistering. We must consider, too, the material and linguistic links between the poems of the period and the cosmetic recipes. So there's a connection between the painted canvases, the cosmetic ingredients, and the poetry of the period that delineated female beauty. Poetic metaphors used to describe female beauty often refer to items that are either used in cosmetic recipes or are allusions even to the cosmos. This anonymous poem from 1593, "The Lily in the Field, that glories in his white, for pureness now must yield and render up his right. Heaven, pictured in her face, doth promise joy and grace. Fair Cynthia's silver light that beats on running streams compares not with her white, whose hairs are all sunbeams. Her virtues so do shine as day unto mine eyne." And in the next example, more of the same, we get further references to ingredients. William Goddard's 1615 poem, "My senses amazed, my hands do tremble, to think what I should my love resemble. Compare her to the rose, her crimson dye is far more pure, her white excels the ivory, unto her skin rouged is the smoothest jet, the softest down to counterfeit. Within her face's circuit there are placed two heavenly suns by whom the world is graced, whose golden beams from her lips exhales, that honeydew with poet's nectar calls. So fair is she, so sweet, smooth, soft, so clear, as on this earth not like her may appear." This correspondence between metaphor and material suggests that Renaissance cosmetic rituals were a response to their contemporary artistic and poetic representations of beauty. One poet itemizes his mistress's beauty by saying, "Her eyes the brightest stars," he declares, "her cheeks red roses, her pretty lips of red vermilion dye." Women were often described as having cheeks like lilies, as you've just seen, and roses, complexions with a silvery hue, teeth and necks like pearl and ivory. Not just natural ingredients, but precious minerals and gems that were gleaned for their cosmetic properties, silver foil, gold even, and we know now that pearl was a popular cosmetic ingredient in the Jacobean period especially. A basic concoction of white lead and vinegar known as ceruse would have created a white, silky facial foundation. At the Globe, we have experimented with some of the non-poisonous materials from the period and found that oils mixed with chalk and pigment create very similar effects that we see in portraits of Renaissance women. We've also experimented with pearl, and the effect is a shimmering glow. It was not enough to be white, as those images of Elizabeth's film portrayal show. One had to be fair, as I keep saying. One had to be shining, achievable through the use of oils, egg glazes, though we have experimented with egg glazes now, and it just creates this sort of hardened shell effect on the face, and secretions even of snails, silver foil, and of course crushed or liquidized pearl. But problematically, using cosmetics was seen by many as immoral and even sinful. Puritans and satirists argued that face paints, lip colors, wigs, perfumes, and other accessories that altered the body actually destroyed God's workmanship. The Puritan Philip Stubbs famously rebukes English women for indulging in such things. Do they think thus to adulterate the Lord, his workmanship, and to be without offense? This analogy obviously posits God as a master painter and the beautifying lady as an amateur painter coming to destroy his workmanship. This analogy occurs again and again in the anti-cosmetic literature of the period. Addressing women directly, Stubbs goes on to say, "Thinkest thou that thou canst make thyself fairer than God who made us all?" Some critics even associated cosmetics with witchcraft and with the devil himself. The devil's craft hath dyed and stained. Because cosmetics undermine God's creation and distract believers from spiritual piety and meditation, even from reading the Bible, because they're too busy looking at themselves in the mirror. In particular, the relationship between witchcraft and cosmetic ingredients is quite explicit, because occasionally very similar, often eerie, ingredients are deployed, such as the tails of lizards used to make an ointment which will make your complexion lighter, the bones of mice to make a dentrifice or tooth cleanser, or even the bones of a hog's jaw can be ground and mixed with oils to create a facial makeup base. Faces were viewed at the time as an important map to the self, though reading the face was difficult, as Duncan in Macbeth admits when he talks about being unable to read the mind's construction in the face. But once hidden beneath a layer of cosmetics, faces could no longer be read at all. So political and sexual hypocrisy, vanity and corruption were all linked to painted faces. Remember Claudius in Hamlet, who talks about the plastering art of prostitutes to describe how he has lied and covered up the truth behind his own actions. There is also a grand myth that only prostitutes wore makeup in this period to cover their syphilis scars, but now we know women of all social backgrounds, from the queen down, painted their faces. However, the syphilitic harlots, as they're described, came to be associated with the painted face, and thus the association developed between cosmetics and traps, and you see that all over the drama of the period. How can painted women be traps? A satirical label for cosmetic paint was bird lime, the substance used to trap pigeons. Critics saw cosmetic paint performing the very same function. Painted beauty allures, but then either the toxic substances in the makeup or the syphilis hidden beneath can trap the man. But now that we understand what the ideal that women were expected to conform to was, the material that they used on their faces, and the opposition to cosmetics, you might be thinking, what does this have to do with the theaters themselves? It leads to the question, how did playwrights respond to the ideology and practice of beauty? One answer is, of course, satire. Ben Jonson was a major satirist of cosmetic practice at court and in the city. His play Cynthia's Revels is about courtly vanity, performed by the children of the Queen's Revels at the Blackfriars in 1600 before the King's men had moved into the indoor playhouse. The epistle addressed to the court provides a warning about the overemphasis on sumptuous display in all its forms. It is not powdering, perfuming, and everyday smelling of the tailor that converteth to a beautiful object, but a mind shining through any suit, which needs no false light either of riches or honors to help it. Note here Johnson's reference to the mind shining, which recalls Ficino's Neoplatonic emphasis on virtue emanating through the body. In the play, using Crites as a mouthpiece, Johnson questions the effeminate and highly artificial display. "Where I have seen the strangest pageant, fashioned like a court, at least I dreamt I saw it, so diffused, so painted, pied, and full of rainbow strains." He later comments on a neophyte glazing of his face, pruning his clothes, perfuming his hair. Clearly, it wasn't just women, but the entire court and all of its inhabitants are infected with a type of cosmetic corruption. But paradoxically, cosmetics were crucial to the performances themselves, a technology of theater production, and something that enabled boys to play women, actors to play ghosts, and may be used in a wide variety of ways to achieve what Andy Gurr has referred to as the implausible illusion of early modern theater. There are a few plays that were performed at Blackfriars that actually exploit specifically the spectacle of cosmetics, and some of these plays are clustered together during a particular period in the 17th century, which is curious. Jonson's comedy Epicene, acquired by the Kingsmen in 1609, Thomas Middleton's Revenger's tragedy, 1607, and the Lady's tragedy, 1611, even Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale, also 1611, Jonson's The Devil is an Ass, 1616, and Philip Massinger's The Duke of Milan, 1626. Why was this? What was it about the performance, the conditions, that sparked an interest in cosmetic spectacle during this cluster of years? There seems to have been a tendency on the parts of these playwrights to appeal to a growing number of female spectators in the Blackfriars Playhouse, female spectators of a certain class, the fashionable elite. Perhaps we could ask at this stage, what did the women who went to see and hear plays at the Blackfriars Theater look like? This slide shows two prominent women, Margaret Leighton and Lady Diana Cecil, one painted by Marcus Gerhardt the Younger and the other by William Larkin. What both show are upper-class fashionability, rich Jacobean embroidery and clothing with an aesthetic that's equal to its financial value. In the Cecil portrait, you see the subtle luster in the curtains behind and in the fabric of her dress. Both women are bejeweled with pearl. So this was fashion at its height. So imagine the playhouse filled with ladies of this ilk. Tiffany Stern has often described the audience at Blackfriars as a living decoration, and you can see why. What also contributed to the repertorial increase in plays that are concerned with glistening cosmetic spectacle was the smaller size, perhaps, of the playhouse itself, its indoor nature as well, both which would have produced better views of the details of clothing, jewelry, and facial beauty. The candlelit atmosphere, coupled with a glittering display of the fashionable and very visible audience, contributed to the growing interest in female-centric themes, including what can very easily be termed cosmetic drama. Scholars have shown that small decorative details more prominent in plays performed in the smaller indoor playhouse. So I want to focus on one ingredient for a moment, its iconic status and its aesthetic value at the time. Pearl, in solid, liquid, or powdered form as a jewel adorning a woman's hair, ears, or dress, as a metaphor, as a poison in the cup of the wine in Hamlet, as a transformative agent of beauty, would have been seen and heard of frequently in the Blackfriars Playhouse and in the Blackfriars repertory by Shakespeare and his contemporaries. How can pearl be a cosmetic, though, you may ask? Crushed pearl has been used in original practices productions at the Globe. It has a sparkling quality. Imagine how this sparkling quality might be brought out by candlelight. A woman with a dusting of pearl on her face might want to sit very near candles so that she appears magically to exude the Neoplatonic luster of virtue. The anti-cosmetic moralist Thomas Tuke, in his Treatise Against Painting, published in 1616, tells us that all painting or coloring of the face is not of one kind, nor by one mean. The more artificial and sumptuous is by tincture, the skin being dried and stained with artificial colors. Then the wealthier sort perform by the help of pearl. Tuke's account suggests that the pearl could be used to stain the face itself or give the face its luster or sumptuousness, as he calls it. Returning to Ben Jonson for a moment, we might remember, if any of you have read his plays, that he was very fond of lists and very fond of jargon and the linguistic registers of material culture. A huge fan of recipe manuals, he seems to be. His countless references to ingredients of all kinds in Epicene, The Alchemist, and The Devil is an Ass show someone who's very interested in the interplay between cosmetic beauty, language, and the economy. it's not unlikely that he came across continental recipe manuals himself. For example, might he have read The Secrets of Isabella Cortese, the Italian alchemist? Her book I Secreti della Signora Isabella Cortese first appeared in print in Venice and introduced alchemy to a wider readership. In it were medical and cosmetic recipes, advice for how to run a household, and discussions of how to turn metal into gold. It was a very popular book which went through several editions into the 17th century. Or perhaps he also had the English translation of Girolamo Rosselli's much reprinted The Secrets of Alexis of Piedmont, which lists a range of concoctions such as against the stinking of the breath, or to know whether a woman shall ever conceive, even to make the skin stretch and return again to its place. I don't know what that means. Amongst this bizarre collection are hundreds of recipes for perfumes, face paints, sweet waters, lip colors, exfoliants, soaps, hair dyes, and tonics for hair removal and hair growth. There are over 50 recipes for concoctions for the face alone. Some of these were known as fucuses, the base foundation, which would have been a white, perhaps sometimes chalky, perhaps sometimes oily or silky substance. In The Devil is an Ass, a character named Whittipole disguises himself as a Spanish lady to pretend to train Madame Fitzdottrell, the wife of a country gallant who is newly moved to the city and is keen to become part of the urban elite. Whittipole, by this point in the play, is curiously well-versed in the cosmetic technologies of the day, specifying the uses of oils of lentisco that make the admirable varnish for the face and gives the right luster, he says. This brief example provides a mere taster of the extensive satirical listing of ingredients we find in Jonson's play. Notice that Whittipole did pick up the language of beauty, specifically luster, and this reference would have resonated with the fashionable female elite amongst the spectators. Jonson also relentlessly mocked strong, assertive women, and in particular, those who presented themselves as the most fashionable. Surely they would have been sitting in the playhouse, too, watching boys dressed and performing a parody of them. These schools of beauty, as they were sometimes known, were a bit like the fashion glitterati today, with the most cutting-edge knowledge of new beauty. New beauty tips, recipes from the continent, specifically the courts of France, Spain, and Italy. So here we might ask, how did the male actors perform this beauty? In The Devil is an Ass, we meet the ladies Tailbush and Eitherside. In Act 4, Scene 3, they're comparing their complexions, and they discuss the most fashionable ingredient in London. I think I have it here. Tailbush asks, what vile fucus is this thou hast got on? Eitherside says, 'tis pearl. Tailbush, pearl? Oyster shells. As I breathe, Eitherside, I know it. This humorous exchange reveals quite a lot about the beauty industry and about theater company practices. What we learn here is that pearl was a desirable and very valuable cosmetic ingredient, but faux pearl, here in the form of oyster shell, has a rather obvious effect on the complexion, as Tailbush mockingly suggests. But what was the desired effect of pearl on one's face? Of course, that glistening shimmering, an effect that is significantly more spectacular under lighting conditions different from those in the outdoor theaters. The Jacobean playwright John Webster writes an epistle to the reader in his edition of The White Devil that his play in performance was not very well received in the amphitheater. Only since it was so acted in so dull a time of winter, presented in so open and black a theater, that it wanted, that which is the only grace in setting out of a tragedy, a full and understanding auditory. Webster's apologetic epistle here suggests the outdoor theaters could produce, at times, a very different aesthetic to the indoor ones, but sometimes quite dull. And if you've seen plays at the Globe when it's quite overcast, you might know what I'm talking about. It is perhaps reasonable to assume that actors would have then adjusted their costume and makeup to suit the particular venue and atmospheric conditions that they were playing in. It's unlikely that real pearl was used as a cosmetic tincture by acting companies, even the fairly well-to-do Kingsmen, but I do think they tried to replicate it, as the clues in the excerpt from The Devil is an Ass seem to suggest. Linguistic signifiers in other plays suggest that As a poetic trope, too, Pearl had a sustained presence in the repertory. In Othello, The Merchant of Venice, and others, pearls are referenced as decorative jewels with exotic significance. Sometimes they are apt images used to describe the tears of women. Sometimes a woman herself is described as a pearl, reflecting her virtue. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, it is the moon that decks the bladed grass with liquid pearl. In addition to its beauty in the verse, it would have been a highly visible decorative jewel adorning the clothing, hair, and makeup of the female spectators in the Blackfriars Playhouse. What Thomas Tuke highlighted for us was the fact that the materials of makeup, like clothing, had social and economic significance. The meaning of different cosmetic ingredients raises important questions when thinking about performance at the socially encoded Blackfriars Playhouse. What we know about these audiences is that they were intimate and significantly wealthier than a majority of the amphitheater audiences. We also assume that there was an increased number of female spectators in the Blackfriars. Either way, the dominant presence of a fashionable female audience would indeed have been a factor in the stylization or aesthetic of performance in this playhouse. The indoor playhouse provided an elite environment for the display of the most current fashions in clothing, accessories, hairstyles, headdresses, and makeup. The smallest details were of the utmost importance and could create exaggerated effects when in close proximity to others, and especially under the glimmering glow of candles. By the same token, people cared a lot about ingredients and materials that were worn or applied to the body because they were so symbolic. Each ingredient held meaning, just like any other object or prop that you find on stage. So how do we read meaning in something like pearl? The pearl for early moderns actually had a rich network of symbolic associations. In addition to being a sign of wealth, pearl had long been considered a symbol of virtue, truth, and chastity. The ancient Greek poet Homer describes goddesses like Juno as being adorned with pearls to emphasize her virtue. Throughout the King James Bible, pearls are often spoken of metaphorically, referring to truth or wisdom. Culturally, there was a long-standing tradition of pearl as a healing agent, linked with the imperfections and ailments of the human body. Midwifery texts, for example, and medical manuals from the 17th century refer to pearl as an ingredient in various recipes. It's used in a recipe, for example, to cure a barren womb, in which it is dissolved or beaten into a powder and made into a confection for consumption. In another, it aids in a cure for illnesses such as the French pox or syphilis. In this recipe, one must extract the quintessence of pearl and mix it with a tincture of coral to make the perfect cordial. As jewels, pearls were popular hair adornments throughout Europe during the Renaissance. In Act 4, Scene 1 of Shakespeare and Fletcher's Henry VIII, Queen Anne enters with her hair adorned with pearl, which is how we know actors simulated current fashion on stage. In some European cities, sumptuary laws limited the number of pearls that could be worn at once in a woman's hair, suggesting that the practice had become fairly widespread and was becoming maybe even a little bit overindulgent. Pearls could be worn in singles or in clusters, combined with various other jewels or goldwork to create elaborate pieces. As contemporary portraits show, they were sometimes sewn onto clothing and worn as earrings, necklaces, particularly chokers, and on pendants as well. However, the booming fashion for pearls gave rise to the false or faux pearl trade. There were several publications from the 15th century on that provide instructions for how to make false pearls using small shells and fish scales to provide the sought-after glistening jewel. Fake pearls could also be sewn onto clothing and worn in clusters as jewels as well. According to a study of jewelry in Shakespeare, imitation pearls might only have cost a penny apiece, the same amount one paid to be a groundling at the Globe. Fake pearls could also be made using powdered glass, egg whites, and snail slime. This type of faux pearl, like the authentic, could be crushed or liquidized, thus providing a cosmetic varnish for flesh and for canvas. So the judgment of painted faces as false has added significance here when the materials in the paint are as inauthentic as the face itself appears to be. If the pearl represents virtue or beauty or purity, and in some circles was thought to have healing powers, false pearl, if used widely as a cosmetic as well as a jewel, complicates this Neoplatonic philosophy of beauty, even while it undermines the elitist fantasy of a privileged access to it. Therefore, I would say Pearl had complicated meanings on stage, sometimes virtue or chastity. But when it was used on the face, its meaning may have blended with the meaning of painted ladies, corrupt female sexuality. So the final question to answer now is what overall effect might have been created by the interplay between cosmetic beauty, candlelight, and performance. As performances move from outdoors to in, there would be a variety of adjustments to make to the staging of the play, its acoustic and its visual features. These adjustments visually include the chromatic shifts that depend upon not only the intensity, but the quality of light within a specific venue. The indoor playhouses may have been brighter in some instances at some points of the performance than the outdoor venues, as Webster's apologetic note to his reader suggests. The scholar Robert Graves suggests that the actors took advantage of daylight to illuminate their permanent indoor theaters, and that this happened is attested to by Thomas Dekker, who noted specific exceptions to the practices. In The Seven Deadly Sins of London, Dekker describes a typical London nightfall, saying that he found that all the city looked like a private playhouse when the windows are clapped down as if some nocturnal or dismal tragedy were presently to be acted. What is really interesting here is the idea that actors could play with light levels indoors in a way that they couldn't in the amphitheaters. How might the modulations of light at Blackfriars then impact upon the effects of color and the visual tenor of the theater? In his essay of Masks and Triumphs, the 17th century essayist Francis Bacon notes that the colors that show best by candlelight are white, carnation, and a kind of seawater green, and ose or spangs, as they are of no great cost, so they are of most glory. As for rich embroidery, it is lost and not discerned. During indoor performances, the visual tone was created by the coming together of all of these elements. Bacon observes, too, that scenes should abound with light. We know, too, that the use of torchbearers in performance at court was a staple of early Tudor interludes, and it is not unlikely that they were used in the indoor stages as well. Taking into account Bacon's instructions, Tiffany Stern attempts to reconstruct the atmosphere of Blackfriars when she suggests that the rich yellow flames brought out the shimmer from the jewels and the metallic threads embedded in the sumptuous clothes of the actor and the audience alike, citing one contemporary description of a gallant's attire as having glistered in the torchy friars. But I want to add to this the glister from painted pearled faces in the audience and on stage. All of what I'm saying shows why the plays written for this venue exploit themes that perhaps indulge these conditions. As we saw earlier with Firenzola's Prescription for Beauty, it emphasized the powerful connections between illumination, chromatics, and the face. Actors knew that a glow from within was perhaps not enough to stage these connections, but the external glow from candles worked to great effect. We know of a German tourist who went to the Blackfriars to see a performance in the early 17th century. He says that the performance by the Children of the Queen's Revels were all acted by lights, which makes great effect. Robert Graves, who I cited earlier, thinks that in all likelihood the audience sat in window light, although I know this is debated, while candles were placed as near the actors as possible to emphasize the splendor of their costumes, and I would add their faces. Artificial light in the Blackfriars would have had to work hard to illustrate the many instances in the repertory where the stage directions call for the luminous display of female beauty. In Thomas Middleton's Macabre, The Lady's Tragedy, performed at the Blackfriars in the winter of 1611, the exhumed body of the lady is brought in state back to court. It's dressed and will soon be painted by her disguised lover to satisfy a usurping tyrant's necrophiliac desires. The stage directions are very interesting. They bring the body in a chair dressed up in black velvet, which sets out the paleness of the hands and face, and a fair chain of pearl across her breast and the crucifix above it. He stands silent a while, letting the music play, beckoning the soldiers that bring her in to make obeisance to her, and he himself makes a low honor to the body and kisses the hand. Here we have a female body highlighted as a saint through a mixture of clothing and jewels, and soon she will have her face painted, making her a paradoxical emblem of sexual object and virtuous saint. she would probably be painted with a fucus of white lead and fake pearl. As a visual exercise in the Blackfriars Playhouse, the entire scene would be illuminated with artificial light, combined with a decreasing natural light towards the end of the performance. The lighting would again amplify the glistening features of the lady, creating a stunning stage picture. It's tempting to consider the audience sitting on stage, the living decoration, would also be glittering in their own rich apparel, creating a joint spectacle of actor and audience, and the audience are as much performer as actor. I want to conclude now by turning to a play that I see as utterly scripted for performance in the Blackfriars. Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale, performed in 1611, the same year as the Lady's Tragedy, also exploits these conditions of the playhouse. The modulations of light from the beginning of performance to the end seem to map neatly onto the play's dramaturgy. If plays were performed at Blackfriars from 2 to about 4 or 5 p.m., then the lighting in the playhouse during the winter would change significantly from beginning to end as the day descends into night. Shakespeare would have known this and perhaps, just perhaps, exploited it dramatically. In Act 3, Scene 2, the devastation of Leontes' jealousy has taken hold, and Paulina informs him that his wife is dead. If word nor oath prevail not, go and see if you can bring tincture or luster in her lip, her eye, heat outwardly, or breath within, I'll serve you as I would do the gods. Here we see that luster is associated not just with virtue, but life itself. But it is the final scene that exploits the conditions at Blackfriars most richly. The statue of Hermione should be glistening with paint, her face and hands at least. Most directors instinctively attempt to illuminate Hermione at this point. When we experimented with the scene in Martin White's set at Bristol, our artistic director also found it necessary to do so, asking the actors to illuminate her with their handheld candles and torches, effectively turning the actors into lighting designers. What creates this instinct is the fact that the language of the scene is drawn heavily towards ocular imagery, seeing, looking, beholding, gazing, marking. And most of the characters comment upon what they are looking at. Spectating and spectating with marvel or wonder is a crucial activity now in this intimate, magical, and touching moment. Masterly done, says Polixenes. The very life seems warm upon her lips. Leontes says they are mocked, with art, but he is quickly barred from kissing the statue as it will stain him with oily painting. In the moment of her awakening, the scene has been set. Music, a prominent feature of indoor playhouse practice, strikes to signal Hermione's movement. Her perhaps pearly painted hands and face move gently. Candles should be glimmering around her and the audience sitting on stage and in the boxes around the stage. They would have had the most privileged view of the queen. Whoops, sorry. Just got rid of my whole presentation. It's just one more slide. That's the last one, actually, so no worries. So the lighting within the Blackfriars, as I've been saying, would have created a distinctive visual identity, very different to the outdoor amphitheaters as fashions and clothing evolved. The beauty ideal didn't, but the materials of makeup varied from decade to decade. What becomes trendy in one decade is no longer trendy in the next. It also varied social class to social class. The ideal of beauty invoked by the use of titillating stage makeup with materials such as pearl had a particular resonance in a playhouse like the Blackfriars with its wealthy female playgoers who could not only see the actors closely, but who also saw each other and no doubt are evaluating everything that they're seeing. Cosmetic spectacle in this atmosphere obviously has to be exploited by the playwrights and theater companies, particularly the Kingsmen, and it soon becomes clear that a new and stunning performance aesthetic emerges and is required for the indoor theaters of the 17th century. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a splendid lecture and a lustrous performance, I must say. Sorry. We've got time for some questions that you can ask Farah now, and I presume there are going to be quite a few. So When you get the microphone, if you want to speak, could you say your name and speak into the mic directly so that it's going to be recorded, your question, and then Farah can respond. Do we have some questions? Who'd like to start? Andrew Gurr. Where's Vanessa with the mic? Could you pass that? Just bear with us.
Technology is wonderful if it works, isn't it? That was such a rich lecture.
Could you speak right into it? Otherwise, it won't pick up. That's it.
Am I speaking to you now? Yes.
Speak directly into it.
I can hear you.
Thanks. And there were so many things to ask. I just want to be quite specific and narrow. I've got two questions, actually, both relating to Whittipole, who was the young character in... Devil is an Ass, written for the Blackfriars. You said he knows a lot about cosmetic. He shows that he knows a lot about cosmetics. And that leads me to wonder, first of all, given that he'd been a boy actor, hadn't he? So he probably paid people like the Spanish lady that he pretends to be in the course of the play, and was obviously young and bright, which seems to me to raise two questions. First of all, if he knows a lot about cosmetics, is it likely that he'd put on his own cosmetics, that he was used to doing it himself? And secondly, would that have been just a function of the boy actors playing women? And would the male actors have been likely to put on makeup as well?
Yes. Those are such excellent questions. I wish I had definitive answers to that. We know, as you know, very little about exactly what was happening backstage. And I know that Natasha Korda is doing lots of work on the way in which women were contributors to dressing actors in the period. If you look at the whatever theater inventories we have left, there's virtually no reference to makeup at all, which suggests that perhaps either it wasn't significant enough, but in terms of its cost, but I don't know if that's true, or that the actors owned their own makeup in the same way they would have owned perhaps their own shoes, depending on what shoes they're wearing. So maybe there is some level of knowledge of putting on their own makeup. I know that we've had references to tire men backstage. Would they be the ones putting on the makeup as well as clothing for the young actors? I just don't know the answer to that, and I wish I did. I just haven't found any clues. I know that aristocratic women were used to being painted by their serving women, and that women of the middle classes painted themselves. So clearly there's some kind of skill that you could learn depending on what stage of the social bracket that you belong to. So I don't know the answer to that question. And in terms of boy actors, you were asking whether adult male actors would have worn makeup. I think it depends on the scene that they're playing. I mean, I have found evidence that ghosts actually would be represented with makeup. So perhaps then an adult male actor would be wearing makeup in that instance. Even the allusions in the play within a play in A Midsummer Night's Dream to the wall having some rough cast alone about them, knowing that those are terms used in the anti-cosmetic discourses to describe painted ladies might suggest that if you put a little makeup on your face, you could play a wall. There's a variety of instances. Fools, for example, might have had makeup on. I don't think it's limited just to representing female characters. I think it might have had several resonances in the drama.
Thanks very much. Do we have another question? There we are. Are we? Yes.
Yes, my name is Regina Kilburn. Two questions. Sure. The first is you really explained in great detail about the white makeup and the pearliness of it, which was wonderful. But I was wondering, first of all, what did they use to get the rosy cheek effect in the lips? Mm. But secondly, you also mentioned that part of the aesthetic was the dark eyes. Mm. And yet, looking at the portraits, there are never any eyelashes and the eyebrows. So did they use any makeups to enhance the dark eye, to make the eye darker?
Yes, good question. I'll address that one first. Dark eyes, meaning sort of the pupils seem to emerge from this white mask. And I think rather than putting makeup on the eyes, it was about not putting makeup on the eyes, which enabled the pupils to come out. Now, I've seen allusions to chemicals being put in the eyes to enlarge the pupils, which may be one aspect of how they did that. For example, you know, Cleopatra's use of coal on her eyes, just don't see any references to that in the 16th century. So my assumption is that it's in the pupil itself, and the white complexion enables the eyes to emerge and to be emphasized. And the other question was the rosy cheeks, yes. Well, there are several ways of achieving that. It depends on what social class you belong to. If you were a country wife or middle-class woman, you might use beetroot to create that effect or some kind of organic substance. You might also use cochineal, it's a kind of red dye used to, made out of bugs, kermes. Or you might use, I know that we've used at the Globe sort of clay, Moroccan clay pots. We've used that as a substance to create the red lips as well. So those are just a few.
Thanks very much. Another question over here. Yeah, thank you.
Hello, I'm Penny. I wondered, since you've mentioned that people and ghosts, you know, people alive and dead were made up, were non-humans like Puck or Titania, were they made up as well?
Mm, that's a really good question. I think Titania, being a woman, I think the actor playing her would have worn makeup. And I've talked about in my book that makeup had a sort of double significance when it's on a boy's face, because sometimes it's just as a theatrical tool used to say, I'm playing a girl, I'm a woman. But then you think about the character of Ophelia, who I don't believe actually wore makeup. And so when Hamlet says, you make yourselves one face, and God gives you one face and you make yourselves another, her trauma from that is that he doesn't actually see her anymore. He's just sort of aligning her with all other women in this misogynistic diatribe. So it has this sort of double significance. So I think certainly, and a queen like Titania should be, she would have her face painted with the best materials from the forest, I imagine. Puck, perhaps, but not necessarily a white face. I mean, there might be other colors. I haven't actually researched the other kinds of uses of makeup in different colors. So it's not unlikely that, you know, somebody like Puck would have makeup on.
Thanks very much. Do we have another question? Can I ask one while we're waiting for another? Maybe I'm wondering about the earliest use of these cosmetic materials by actors, mm-hmm. and possibly the audience as well, bearing in mind that the earliest elite audiences and playhouse spaces were at Paul's and then the Blackfriars and were boy actors. Because they were younger, does this mean that they wouldn't have used cosmetic materials? What's the evidence?
No, I think they would have had to use cosmetic materials. I think all boy actors use cosmetic materials. I mean, when you say evidence, the evidence I've used is the repertory itself and what's happening in the plays. And I think we tend to look at original practices productions at the Globe and think, oh, it's not, you know, it's not really plausible. It looks odd, but these boys, I've seen boy actors perform with makeup on, and it's very, very convincing. And one of the things you have to remember is that the way in which women are described in this period as being beautiful, the sort of white and rosy cheek, for example, that young, beautiful boys are described in exactly the same way. Adonis is described in the exact same terms as Venus in Shakespeare's poem. And so that it's not hard to go from there to imagine that just putting a bit of rouge and a bit of white, pale glisten on the face of a young boy could actually be quite convincingly a female.
Thank you. Yep, that answers my question. Thanks. Do we have another question about the lecture? Thank you.
Michaela Leach, I wondered if all these enhancements were in any shape, form detrimental to the skin, to the lips, to the, and do we know of any instances when, because as a lady, maybe you'd only make up, so to speak, when you went out, but as an actor, you probably had to do it day in and day out. Do we know if there were any problems at all?
That's a really good question. We know that there are separate accounts, not related to actors, of women who actually have suffered as a result of wearing white lead. So it has effect. It can affect the teeth. It can deteriorate the teeth. It can make your hair fall out. These are stories that accounts in separate places. I haven't read anything or found any evidence about actors and the deterioration on their faces. It's really a good question. Really good question.
Anyone else want to comment on that?
Just one more. You've really got me thinking now. And at the end of Romeo and Juliet, when he looks at her and he comments on the fact that there are still roses in your cheeks and your lips, I've always thought he's just being stupid and doesn't realize she's alive. But is there some other comment he's making? Mm-hmm. Is he recognizing that something else about her? Is it about makeup rather than about the fact that she isn't really dead?
It might be. I mean, Shakespeare's always being meta-theatrical, so his plays are always on one level referring to the kind of technologies of theater. And you get that so beautifully in Twelfth Night, for example, when Olivia is asked by Viola to remove her veil so she can see her face. And she said, it's great if God did all. So, and then Olivia says, oh, this is all very natural, don't you know? And so obviously when Mark Rylance, heavily painted on the Globe stage, says that, it's very funny. So it can have a really humorous effect because of that meta-theatrical resonance. So it may, I mean, obviously that's not a moment for humor, but there might be some meta-theatrical hint in that moment, yes.
Thank you. Do we have another question? Yes, over here. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm Paul LaRochelle. I have a question if you have any thoughts about the connection between cosmetics and disguise, in particular situations like Portia or Rosalind, where you have boy actors playing women playing men, if you think the cosmetics would have stayed underneath the disguise or if the cosmetics would have been removed and then reapplied, or if that would have been impossible.
Yeah, no, I think it's all possible. I imagine that they wouldn't be wearing makeup because when they're playing boys, girls playing boys, because it's a material signifier for femininity. And I think if maybe there's a hint of some red, I don't know. You could play with it as a theater company now, I suppose. But I've never imagined that they would keep their makeup on. But so when they do reveal their disguise, if they do, then coming out with makeup on might actually create that. But, you know, when I think about boy actors painting their faces, I don't think about that sort of Glenda Jackson image. You know, it's very subtle and actually it could be very, very beautiful as well. So, there is no definitive answer to that, I'm afraid. But good question.
Thank you for that. Do we have another question? Presumably this pearl glistening effect is, it benefits from having the light shining on, obviously. But does it have any more penetrating kind of significance in terms of the text? I mean, can it distract from the text?
Can it distract from
the text? Well, that it's trying to illustrate something from the text sometimes. The idea of the pearl. I can't remember. I think it was the Pearl of Knowledge or something. It was one of these the biblical books that weren't part of the canon.
Yeah.
I think going back to pre sort of pre-Christian times almost. It's to do with knowledge as well. I suppose what I was trying to get at.
Yeah.
How far into the idea of there being something? You talk about purity, reflecting
purity,
a certain purity.
And also wisdom.
On the sort of, you know, the gradations of knowledge to wickedness. This end, you know, the positive end. Would people be thinking about, I don't know, sophism, being knowledgeable, that this character is knowledgeable through their...
That's a good question. Possibly, I don't know. I mean, it's really hard to say what people were thinking. I mean, I really don't know how to answer that question. I mean, in terms of the dramatic texts, you can see resonances, as I showed you that example with... Lady Either Side and Tailbush from Devil is an Ass, where they're actually saying the word pearl in reference to makeup on their face, knowing that there are women in the audience probably who have it on their faces for real. So I think there are lots of textual registers in the drama itself, but in terms of whether people who are watching these plays and listening to them are actually thinking about sort of sophistic ideas, I'm not sure. It's hard to say. Any more impossible questions? Thank you. Thank you, and thanks for having me.